Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Humans have long wondered if life exists elsewhere in the universe. NASA is sending a spacecraft to Jupiter's icy moon Europa in 2030, as it might be one of the most favorable places to discover life beyond Earth. In advance of that expedition, NASA is turning to oceanographers and biologists to better understand conditions under which we might find life. NASA's astrobiology program solicited grant proposals from throughout the country, and of the four flagship research projects selected, two are being led by researchers here on Cape Cod, Chris German's lab at HUI and Emil Ruff's lab at MBL. Later in the hour, we talk with them about their research and its applications for space exploration. But first, we talk with Mira Submarinian. She's an award-winning freelance journalist who writes about the personal and the planetary in a time of climate crisis. Her most recent project is A Better World is Possible: Global Youth Confront the Climate Crisis. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Mindy. It's so great to be back.
So this is a little bit different than your previous books.
Yes, very different.
A graphic novel, and you teamed up with a wonderful illustrator. So tell us how that relationship came to be.
Yeah, it was kind of just wonderful chance. It was right before the pandemic. It was one of the last events that I went to out in the world. Danica Novgorodoff is the illustrator, and we were mutual friends, and we ran in the same circles in New York years ago. And so we were at a mutual friends book event in Brooklyn in like January 2020, when everything seemed just fine. And I just said, "Hey, Danica, well, like, what are you working on?" And she was working. She already had a book deal to work on a graphic novel that had evolved over time, and it turned into that she wanted to focus on youth climate activists. And she was just struggling with like not really knowing climate change. How do you write about this big thing? You know, it was not her. She's an illustrator. She's an artist. So she said she was struggling with the story, like how to make it into a story. And I'm like, hey, I do story. Like, let's talk. And then we just kept talking. And weirdly, we have not been in the same room since.
Oh, how funny.
Since then. She's in Louisville, Kentucky. But we have like become fierce collaborators. It's been really great.
So as you're putting, and this is, you know, you follow the personal stories of four other young people. So you've got that part of it, plus all the science. Are you writing the story and then she's adding the illustration?
Yeah, there was a whole, I mean, we worked collaboratively the whole way. So I took the lead on writing the manuscript and just like coming up with the idea of the structure. And so we basically wanted to figure out, you know, we learn through stories. Like that is just how we understand the world. And so you can't just dump a bunch of information about climate change on people and think that they're going to care. Like, why should we care? Why do young people care? So Danica was actually at the 2019 climate strike in New York City, which was like 250,000 people on the streets. There were millions of people all over the world protesting that day. And so we're like, that's a great scene. Like that's a great anchor point. Like, let's find out who were the kids who were part of organizing this like incredible event. Like, let's find those kids. And so then that was just fun, me as a journalist going to be doing all the investigative part to like, who were those kids and why were they there?
And we hear the stories, and we're hearing stories of their personal stories of these kids, but it's global. It's not just in one part of the country or one country even. It's you know, obviously climate change is happening all over the world. So the kids highlight that. And also your story is in there.
Yeah, me and Danica didn't really want to be in the book, really. We wanted to just focus on the four youth that we ended up zeroing in on. But it just felt a little coy. Like we wanted to, you know, if we were going to share their stories, we had to kind of show the reader like why we were there, like why did we care? And we were coming into it from a different generational perspective. Danica's younger than me, but so both of us have our different reasons for why we care about this issue. And then also like besides the four kids' stories, we also wanted to weave in a bunch of like really good information that helped readers connect the dots about like why should they care about climate change? Not just why do these kids care, but also why should you care? And so there are interludes sprinkled throughout the book. That was a nice device, narrative device for me and Danica to basically be in conversation, learning about those subjects.
I like that it shared your story because it also gives you the credibility of where do these facts come from? And, you know, you've got fact checkers and it gives you really kind of this history of climate change. And, you know, when you talk to young people about climate change. That is like the top of that's their top priority, right? What are your thoughts as to why these young people seem to take it more seriously than many adults do?
Yeah, I mean, anybody older kind of has that, you know, what do they call it when you've already like quit your job in your head, your leaver syndrome or something? Yeah. You know, anybody younger is going to be facing this for the rest of their lives. And we are seeing changes happen in real time, all of us everywhere. And so we're seeing our weather change. We're seeing, and, you know, as older people can say like, oh, it wasn't like this when I was a kid. But, you know, I'm saying things like it wasn't like this 15 years ago. And so young people recognize that what they are looking at is going to be exponentially worse, and they are the ones who are going to carry the brunt of it. I mean, just talking about the responsibility that older people have to future generations, this is a very, very real, tangible responsibility we have.
Yeah, the kids are saying, hey, you're not doing enough. We have to pick up the ball and run with it. But also, I wonder, too, if it's somewhat denial. You know, you don't want to face it because it's so overwhelming and so depressing, right?
Yeah,
For some people, they just don't want to face it. So what is the age group the book is targeting?
This part has been so fascinating since the book just came out on March 3rd, and we wrote it for a young adult audience. And so in my mind, I was thinking like, ninth grader or something, ninth, 10th grader. But we did try to write it on multiple levels, and it feels like I'm so delighted hearing feedback now that it's out there in the wild of like people seem to be applying it to all different ages. I have a friend who was reading it to her 5-year-old, and she said like that was like, you know, she was being able to like, obviously they're taking in information in different ways. And then other people who are like climate activists who are adults, and they're saying they're learning stuff. We had a conversation with Amy Westervelt of the Drilled podcast, and she is an incredible investigative journalist who's been on the climate change beat for years. And she was saying like she's reading it, and she was like, oh, this is actually a really great tool for me to talk to my 13-year-old about climate change. This is my world, but like, how do we have these conversations like with our kids and with people that we care about? So, yeah, it's finding
it's
a great
resonating
home.
With yeah. everybody. So when you look at this issue of climate change, as we're saying, it can be really depressing. It can seem very overwhelming. Is part of the goal here to show what can be achieved when tackling this more on a local level? Because, you know, you look global and you're like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? But it's not as overwhelming when you're looking local.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we really do try to show how the impacts are global and the inequality of the impacts is global. But we also try to show, especially through the solutions that we feature at the end, that there's all these things you can do, from like the really simple how you use your food or don't use your food in your kitchen to ambitious things about how to make policy change and litigation and all these other ways to enact change. But part of it also we talk about is just finding community, finding other people who care about it. Catherine Hayhoe is a wonderful climate scientist and communicator, and she talks so much about like just the power of conversations. Like so many people are worried about climate change. The numbers have just gone up and up and up. The number of people who are alarmed, according to Yale researchers, has doubled in the past, you know, 15 years or so. And so, but the conversations don't happen. And so, like, just talking about it and realizing that your other people care about this issue is a big form of activism.
Yeah, also, you know, this what we call ecological grief, right? It's like it can be, and it's a real thing.
It's a very real thing.
Yeah, and you talk about that in the book as well.
Yeah, and this started coming up because I teach as well, and this started coming up in the classroom. I want to say, like, you know, 2018, 2019, that it was coming up where, you know, undergraduate students are asking me, like, should I have a kid? Mm-hmm. These really, really big human life questions, and they were questioning them because of the future that they are growing up into. And so, like, we definitely wanted to tackle eco grief, and it's Danica and I deal with it. The youth who are in this book deal with it. We try to just face it really head on, of like that finding the community of other people who care about this, and working your, like, dealing with anger or rage or sadness by acting is really, we try to talk about hope as a verb.
Yeah. And I want to talk about a couple of the interludes that stand out. Environmental injustice.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there is so much inequity built into what's happening with the climate crisis. On basically all levels, there's inequity happening, everything from, like, fossil fuel extraction and processing and everything are in disproportionately allocated to communities that do not have the means to fight them, that are poorer, that have poorer health outcomes. All of those inequities are happening right here in our country. They're happening, you know, I mean, there's an interesting thing even just right here in our backyard in Cape Cod, where there's a lot of fight against wind power, as you know. WCII has done a great job of covering that. But New Bedford is lower income, and they're looking at jobs, and they're much more supportive of trying to support this industry that, like, 3,500 jobs came from Cape.
Yeah.
You know, the most recent wind turbine project. So, like, the inequities happen everywhere. And then on the global scale, Americans just use so much more energy. We are creating the carbon emissions that are going to put Bangladesh underwater. And one of the youth that we write about, Rebecca Subnam, is from Bangladesh and experienced floods as young as 5 years old when she was there before she moved to New York. And so we're seeing, like, the actual effects of what this means.
Yeah. This was, I thought, surprising. You have a chapter or interlude on the role of religion.
Yeah. Yeah, this is another thing that seems like it gets disregarded. But, I mean, when we think about it, like, religion is the stories of our world. Like, so many people are shaped by the religious stories that they learn growing up about their world and what we owe it. It's stories that come from ancestors, from generations past, and therefore reflects how we're supposed to, like, live into the future for generations that are to come. And so to disregard the role of the faith community's stance in this, like, there was a great quote from Daniel Kahneman, the economist, of saying, like, if we could just get preachers, you know, speaking about climate change from the pulpit. And we have seen really the opposite in terms of, like, the Christian right in this country today not speaking about it, instead speaking about end times and, like, the opposite of a hopeful future. But but we give examples of every religion.
Every religion, yeah.
Every religion has a component. Maybe it's not the dominant component, but has fundamental ideals about caring for, about repair. In Judaism, there's about the idea about tikkun olam, which is, like, the repair of the world. There's in Hinduism, in Muslims, every faith has a component that is recognizing that if you believe in a creator, they created this, and it's our job to take care of it.
There's also a timeline of climate events over the past 250 years. There's a lot of information.
That's
there.
That's probably not for the five-year-old.
No, definitely not. But it's interesting because it kind of reminds you, right, of how, where we are and how we got here.
Yeah. I mean, I have been doing climate and environmental journalism for 20 years and doing environmental work, like, for 30. But it's even doing that timeline, it's so wonky in some ways, but it shows so much. It just tells this whole story. Like, when do you think that we knew how to get electricity from, like, windmills and solar panels? And we probably think, oh, that's, like, a new green thing. Like, no, like 1880s,
yeah.
You know, like a long time ago. And then we start weaving in, like, okay, so when did the fossil fuel companies know from their own science that it was going to continuing to burn fossil fuels was going to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that was going to cause warming, that was going to melt glaciers and pole ice and cause sea level rise? Oh, yeah, they knew that in 1968.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So you've been, as you said, covering climate change and climate science for 20 years. What do you see over those two decades? Has anything changed? Are people more accepting now, less accepting? What are your thoughts as to what's changed in those 20 years?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I mean, it's gone through these, like, ups and downs and ups and downs. Like there have been, you know, there was the while like around maybe 2010 or 2005 to 2010 where scientists were like, wait, we just need to give them more information and then they'll know. And like going back to narrative being how we process our worlds, that doesn't work. You can't give data points of doom and expect people to act. So so storytelling started entering the idea about climate narratives after, I would say, about 2010-11. But also that was the same time that social media kind of took off and our attention spans were gone. And now we're in a totally, you know, and I feel like it really was rising around the time that 2019 strike happened. This was the time of Greta Thunberg. She sailed across the Atlantic to come to that strike in New York. And there was a lot of action. And since then, the political environment has been really hard. I mean, everybody is facing the rise of authoritarianism in this country and trying to figure out where to put granted human finite energy and time towards what fights to fight. So climate feels like it's kind of gone onto a back burner, which is really unfortunate because I maintain that climate change is the story of our century, and I feel like it's going to be the one that is going to dominate even amid all this political strife. And seeing what's happening in Iran right now, I mean, the amount of emissions that are released, the fight over oil that's happening, you know, like everywhere on all the people who are in the climate space that I inhabit these days are just like, you can't stop sunlight or wind in the Strait of Hormuz. Like this is, you know, it's talking about geopolitical freedoms in some way to talk about moving to a greener, cleaner renewable energy system.
One of the interesting things about the book is you talk about stories, and it isn't just the science, right? It touches on social implications as well.
Yeah, because it's all woven together. There's no separating these things. And I think that was also a thing that missed in the narrative, that if you just talk about the science, that that's going to get the story across and make people care. Like, it affects people's very real lives. I mean, we now – I have a friend in North Carolina who's evacuated and been caught in four major life-threatening floods. You know, Asheville was just one of them, but she was caught in other ones in Kentucky. So talking about like just the personal trauma of that, you know, even just going through one catastrophic flood and every time you get a hard rain, your heartbeat goes up a little bit. And so these very real events are making climate change like people are increasingly recognizing it's happening here, it's happening now.
And as again, you don't want to be too depressing, right? So you've also got solutions.
Yes, we have so many solutions. And they're not like make-believe, like, oh, maybe someday we'll invent some magical power source. Right. Like, no, the solutions are all right here. The U.S. is going backwards at a really fast pace of dismantling a lot of the solutions that were ramping up. But the rest of the world is moving forward. It is amazing. I mean, 93% of the power that got installed last year was renewable. Mm-hmm. It's the cheapest, fastest way to get people clean energy.
I love the at the end of the book, the end. It's got to be not the end.
Spoiler.
Yeah. So what is it you hope people take away from the book?
That enacting change is not that hard, that 15-year-olds can figure out how to do it, that we want to support future generations and hope that they want to raise future generations of their own and give them a world where that feels possible. So it's figuring out how to support them, how to live a life that is working towards a saner, more stable. I mean, we've been very lucky to live in a stable climate for 10,000 years since the last ice age, since this was buried under ice right here. We'd like to make that world possible for young people. And so I'm hoping this book will help readers of all ages find ways to do that and feel like it's possible.
The book is A Better World is Possible, Global Youth Confront the Climate Crisis. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Mira Subramanian, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you,
Mindy. And thanks for writing the book.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, we talk with researchers from HUI and MBL, awarded grants from NASA's astrobiology program. Stay with us.